Now, as you know, Patrick Quirk was sentenced to life imprisonment for a crime. It was claimed he committed because of his jealousy of the relationship between his former girlfriend, Mary Lowry, and Bobby Ryan. But, I mean, as you read the commentaries and some of the papers, there's also speculation that it was about money. And that he was looking for land and money through Mary. Now, whether that is the truth or not, we don't know. Bobby Ryan was a much-loved father and grandfather. He was a quarry worker and part-time DJ known as Mr. Moonlight. The anguish of losing him in such a brutal fashion will never, ever leave his children, Michelle and Robert. Both of them testified in court during this longest murder trial on record in the country. And to some extent, because people were so interested in all the ins and outs of everybody else, you might have thought that Bobby Ryan didn't get enough attention. Well, yesterday, I spoke to his daughter, Michelle. It was her first interview since the conclusion of the court case. And I began by asking, had she and her family been able to return to any form of normality?
Well, I don't think that there is any such thing as normal left for us. You know, we're just under 8 years of having our world turned absolutely upside down and inside out. Like, there's no returning back to normal for us. Looking forward, I don't think, I'm hoping and praying someday that justice, God for Daddy, will bring us a sense of peace in our lives someday.
Yeah.
But at the minute, it's not looking like that. You know, like, justice is done. But as far as we're concerned, you know, like, we're never going to have our father back. You know, it's not going to bring him back.
Yes. Yes, our granddad won't be back for your children.
Definitely not. No, Granddad Bob. You know, we have tears now more so than ever, you know, about they want their Granddad Bob back. And, you know, like, the oldest grandchild there is 13, but, like, you're going underneath that as well. So how do you explain the cruel circumstances, you know? You just can't.
And as the trial was going on, how did you protect the children? How many grandchildren are there altogether?
There are 6 grandchildren.
Right.
You know, there was no protecting them. Like, we shielded them to the best that we could. And then when the court case, you know, when it started getting the media attention that it did,
yeah,
like, we knew that definitely, you know, they were going to be seeing pictures of Granddad Bob on newspapers inside the shops, you know. It was actually my eldest lad heard it on the school bus on the way to school one morning, and I was on the train on the way up to the court, and he messaged me. He said, "Mom, I'm after hearing something about Granddad Bob on the bus." And I remember just thinking, oh wow, I think I was passing Ballybrophy at the time, and I was there, oh my God, like, what? Like, what do I do? What do I do?
Yeah.
You know, so I kind of, like, took it from there. That evening, came home and sat him down, and, you know, I did explain to him in a roundabout way. But as for that, like, I mean, there was no shielding them. No matter what we could do anymore, it was out of our control. The media, like, the media attention was just huge on it, as you know yourselves.
Absolutely.
So, you know.
Yeah, that's very tough. You know, people often obviously concern themselves with the main people in a story, but they forget that there is collateral damage all over the place.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Like, as I said now, you know, there's all over schools, all over towns. There was no getting away from it. You know, like, our shielding was from the 3rd of June 2011 right up until the 14th January 2019. We shielded them, the grandchildren, as much as we could.
Yeah.
But after the 14th of January and progressing on, and the more the trial, you know, escalated, the bigger it seemed to get. And then you had all this huge public support. You know, people mean well. They
yes.
really do.
Yeah.
But we couldn't even go into the shops. You know, we had our kids with us and they were coming over. And, you know, as I said, they mean well. but...
Of course.
You know, we had the children with us and it was kind of like, oh, now, you know, this is another... It's going to be an hour before we can pull out of the car park here with the crying and the tears and explaining, you know.
Yeah. You were clearly very close to your dad. Tell me about him, first of all. Who was he and what was he like? I noticed one commentator saying whenever his name was mentioned to a witness, their eyes lit up.
Oh, Marion, he was the absolute life and soul of our world. He really was an exceptional man. Really, the only word I can use to describe him was wow. You know, he had a passion for music, and when he was behind his machine, you could really feel, it wasn't even through his music, but you go up, stand up anywhere near him at all, and you could feel the passion burning out through him for his love of music. Absolutely, he could walk into an empty room and get things dancing. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
He really and truly was the most cheerful man that I have ever had the blessing of knowing, and I have the honour of calling him my father.
And tell me, how did the name Mr. Moonlight come about? And then you took it up yourself as Shelley Moonlight.
Oh, well, now, Mr. Moonlight, there was a song he used to sing. I can't think of the name, but the chorus was something like they go walking underneath the moonlight, and that's where his stage name came, was Moonlight. And then I started getting into the DJ and then behind him, and I remember from my first ever gig, as we call it, it was in a local pub in Cashel, and he went down and he set up the stuff for me, and he came up and he said, "Now," he said, "come on," he said, we're ready, come on, we'll go down." So I went down, and I'll never forget looking at the pub window. It was an luminous orange sheet of paper with big black writing, DJ Shelley Moonlight. And that's he actually gave me my stage name, we'd say. It was underneath him. I started off with him, and I finished with him on the last night I ever, ever was going to get to see him.
Did you really? Tell me, it was, I gather, a scorching day.
Oh, it was. It was beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. The sun was just beaming. We woke up that morning. Everything was grand. Little did we know that sunshine was soon going to turn into the darkest place we could ever possibly imagine to be in our lives.
Yeah.
And that was the disappearance of our father, Bobby Ryan.
And it was his boss calling to the house?
It was, yeah. My father, you could set your clock to him. Honest, he was... I think we knew him better than he knew himself.
Right.
And his boss, it just goes to show how reliable of a worker that Daddy was, because when Daddy never showed to the quarry that day, his boss didn't even ring. He wouldn't even ring. He came directly to where Daddy was living to actually see if Daddy was all right, you know?
Yeah.
Because he heard nothing from Daddy. And my brother then went back to the house, and his partner, she didn't actually know it was Daddy's boss, but she gave my brother the description. And Robert said, "Hang on a minute, that was Daddy's boss. That was Niall Quinn." So next Saturday, Robert got into his car and done a drive around, and then he rang me. And I said, "Right." I said, "Don't panic a minute." I said, "It's a beautiful day." I said, "Maybe," I said, "he is taking the day off, even though we were kind of 70-30 on that. I knew he wouldn't take the day off without notifying his boss, you know."
Yeah.
He would never just do it for the moment on him. He'd always try and make sure that his boss could drive the lorry, or that somebody could drive the lorry, so that his boss wouldn't be, you know, out of pocket for it.
Yeah.
And, I don't know, as the morning progressed, then I couldn't get through to him. Robert couldn't get through to him. You know, there was a sense of panic, in a sense. But it really wasn't until Robert actually rang me back when I got to my aunt's house and said, "Shell, Daddy's van still isn't in Killock." So I think that was the time then, really, where alarm bells were kind of echoing. So my aunt and my uncle came with me in my car. My uncle was driving. And I said to him, I turned to my aunt in the car and I said, we're going to find Daddy or the van in the woods. And I don't know what, I don't have an explanation as to why I ever felt that strong about the woods, because the father used to have myself and Robert terrified of going into the woods. If you go in there, he said, you'll never again come out. He said, stay out there. You know, he was very much like that. So I don't know what put the woods into my head, but it was an awful, sickening feeling that I had. And we went down by Left Borsley, went down on by Dundrum. And then when I got to Tipperary Town, I got the same sickening feeling. Like, it's almost like I couldn't breathe. And I said to my uncle, I said, take me to the Garda station. I said, we need to go to the Garda station now.
Right.
And then, yeah, and I went and explained to them, you know, that this is completely out of his character. You know, he'd never go off, and he definitely wouldn't take no day off, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And as I was like, he used to ring me the whole, like 20 times a day he used to ring me. So when I wasn't receiving any phone calls back from him, I mean, like, there was definitely something wrong.
Right. Now, you know, you rang Mary Lowry, is that correct?
I did, yeah. I rang Mary Lowry, and, you know, she said that they didn't have an argument or whatever, and everything was fine. He went to work. She saw him driving down the drive, but she didn't see what way, whether he went left or right at the end of it. So I rang Robert, and I said, look, Robert, I said, Mary said that she see him leaving. I said, that this morning, I said, but I said, she said that she's going to try and ring him now or whatever. Mary Lowry then rang me back and said that she couldn't get a hold of him. So, like, that was before I had actually landed into Tipperary Town myself.
Yes.
So after leaving the Garda station, then I tried Daddy's friend, Mary Glasheen, to see if maybe he had been over there, or if his van was there, maybe they might have decided to take off for the day. And there was nobody, there was no answer at Mary's house. So Mary Lowry rang anyway, and she said, come out to my house, but I didn't know where it was. So the heel of the hunt anyway, she came in, and she was visibly upset. So I said to my aunt, my uncle, I said, look, I said, I am going to go, I said, in the car with Mary. I said, she is visibly upset, I said. So on the way out then, I knew that there was a bench of woods because I heard of it. Now, what proximity that was to Mary Lowry's home, I didn't know. So I just asked Mary, you know, how far is the bench of woods from your house? And she said, about a mile and a half to 2 miles. I said, we have to go there, I said. And I suppose, kind of like, I was kind of panicky myself at that stage. I don't even, when we came up to the Kilshan Woods, I don't even think Mary's car was actually pulled up. I just jumped out and started running over towards the van. It was like I was running forever. I thought I'd never get there.
It's quite extraordinary that you had this feeling.
Yeah, I could never, excuse me, I could never explain, and still to this day, I couldn't explain where that feeling or how strong that feeling was that came over me. I have no explanations for that, even to this day, and we're nearly 8 years down the road from it, and I still don't know where that feeling came from.
But I'm sure you're glad. Now, just when you talk about Mary Lowry, they're all fitty-footy in everybody together. I mean, you knew your father was having a relationship with her, and you knew her, but not very well.
Yes, yeah. I mean, like, we would have met in the socialising scene there in Pat Fox's, you know. Any time that I wasn't DJing, I used to be, sure, myself and the father, like, you wouldn't see one without the other, really. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I used to be in there with him, and, you know, Mary was there, you know, a lot of the times that he used to be playing inside there. So I would have been meeting her there, or if I was at Daddy's house and she should call,
yeah,
I'd maybe have a cup of coffee or whatever and leave him at it then. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know.
So in terms of your father and her and Mr. Quirk, everybody kind of knew everybody else, did they? Nobody was a stranger to anybody else.
Oh, no, no. We'd say Mary Lowry would have been related to Patrick Quirk through marriage.
Yeah.
You know, but regarding Daddy knowing Mr. Quirk, I don't actually think, you know, that I know that Daddy was in his presence a couple of times and he wasn't happy about it. You know, he just said that he just didn't like to be in his company. You know, that was before Daddy was actually aware of anything going on between Mary and Pat at the time. And it wasn't, I suppose, until the text messages came through to Daddy's phone did he know then. And I just remember telling Daddy, like, Daddy, I said, I don't want you, I said, in their company. Because Daddy used to confide in me an awful lot.
Yeah.
He really did. You know, he could ring me, as I said, 20 times a day. But if there was ever anything bothering him now or anything, you know, he'd pick up the phone and he'd say, you know, Shelley, can I ask your opinion? And I'd give him an yeah. honest opinion. You know, he knew I was straight, just shoot from the hip. Like, you know, whether he liked the answer or not, he knew I was going to give him the right one anyway.
So tell us the content of those texts.
Well, I can't really disclose, you know, it's not that I can't, but I would prefer not to disclose them if that was okay.
Okay, that's okay. Your father had been hitting a bad patch in his relationship with Mary Larry after they'd been away to Bundoran, and he came to you for advice.
He did, yeah. It was the Tuesday, and he had rang me and he had told me, you know. And I'm not going to use my exact saying now. Again, I'm sure everybody across the country has heard exactly what I did.
Was this the P45?
Yes, that was, yeah. So basically, to get rid, I said, Daddy, I said, come on. I said, at your age, I said, you don't need that. I said, it's not healthy. I said, just cut your ties from it, you know. I said, stop it now. I said, we were down this road with your head fried before. I said, I am not doing it again. I said, no. I said, stop now, Daddy, I said, and think about it. I said, you need to grab a hold of this situation, I said.
And he had separately tried to help Patrick Quirk.
Is this the meeting in Hayes's?
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember that day he rang me. He was parking the van in Thurles, and he rang me to say that he was meeting Mary Lowry and Patrick Quirk in the front bar of Hayes's. I was like, and I'm not going to mince words, I was like a tyrant. I said, Daddy, I said, in the name of God, I said, why didn't you call for me? I said, to go with you. You know, because Daddy was the type of man where, I mean, if he thought that he could build a bridge someplace,
yeah,
he would have built a bridge. You know what I mean? Even though he had nothing to build a bridge from. You know what I mean? Whereas I, on the other hand, I probably would have walked in the front door of Hayes's, and that's probably why he wouldn't have brought me. I probably would have walked in the front door of Hayes's, turned around and said to him, look, leave me father alone.
Yeah.
Do whatever you want to do, the two of you, but just leave my father alone. And that would have been the end of that meeting. But he didn't. He said, look, he said, I'll go in. He said, and I'll see what has to be said. And I said, and I goes, I said, Daddy, I said, you better ring me, I said, when you come straight out, like. And he said that he started laughing. And he said, I will. He said, hold on to here. He said, I will. And he rang me anyway. And he told me that, you know, that Pat Quirk had apologised for his carry-on or whatever. And, you know, that they shook hands on it or whatever. And that was it. And I said to Daddy, I said, like, what? I said, I can't, and I still can't understand to this day why he's entertaining it. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, Daddy, like, I said, it's changed times. I said, seriously, Daddy, I said, you're no fool. I said, please, I said, stop letting these people walk over you. They were my exact words.
Well, I know you didn't want to say what was in the text, but I gathered they were hostile and that he was trying to make good of it all. It was supposed to have broken up after Bundoran, and then two nights later, he was in Mary Lowry's again.
He was, yeah. I have no explanation for that. I keep asking him every night, just tell me why you went over, you know? Because to my knowledge, and I've said this from the start, and like to my knowledge, he did cool things off. You know,
yeah,
he did cool things away off. You know, he even said that they'd take a break for a while and see what happens. You know, because as I said, my father wasn't a confrontational man.
Yes,
you know, he got on with everybody. He talked to the stones. He wouldn't even want them to talk back. He'd do all the talking for them. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And he wasn't a confrontational man. He was a jolly man. He loved to enjoy himself. You know. Laughter was, you know what I mean? Laughter was, Bobby and laughter just went together.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you'd had advised Mary Lowry yourself and saying, don't be hanging around with my dad if you, you know, because he'll talk to everybody and then you'll be hurt.
I did. Well, like, my father, he had a very jolly sense of humour. You know, I think that's where he used to take from it that, well, Shelley, you're kind of like me, like, the apple didn't fall too far from the tree. That was one of our jokes, you
right,
know?
Right, yeah.
And he was very jolly, you know, but he I won't even call it sarcastic, but he always had a joke. And especially in behind the disco machine, everybody loved Moonlight, you know? And you'd have people coming in, you know, going up, rubbing the back of his head, and, oh, Moonlight, you play my song for me, and all of this, and
yeah.
No bother, no bother, no bother. And he'd even go out and he'd dance with them.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I did turn around to Mary. Well, I said, if you're sensitive, I said, he's not the man to be with. Do you know what I mean? It was laughable, but that's the way it was.
Right.
You know what I mean? It was me and Daddy. It was always a laugh when you were around him. There was no heavy heartedness or, you know, none of that.
Your immediate concern about your father, he and your mother had broken up and he'd been very down after that. And was that partially why you were thinking Woods? I mean, were you thinking that he might take his own life?
Absolutely no way.
No way.
There was, it was like different scenarios. Like, I suppose every scenario is better than the scenario you're faced with. He's after coming to harm. You know what I mean?
Yes, yeah.
There was a scenario running through my head where, like, you know, did I not spot it? Like, was there a sign there? But then when I got my thoughts back together, I was there. I was actually disgusted with myself for even thinking that, because, number one, Daddy would have never have done that to myself and Robert.
Right.
Absolutely, 100%, no way
right.
would he have done that to myself and Robert. You know, like, he was down after the separation to my mother. There was 20 years of marriage there. So, you know, like, there was.
But, very, I mean, understandable.
Of course, yeah. And, I mean, we talked through it. We talked about it every day. I'd ring him, you know, every few minutes to make sure he was okay. You know, and he was, like, I mean, it was about maybe, what, a good 12 months after, maybe a little longer than 12 months, where I was starting to see the daddy coming back with me.
Right, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, eventually then I could just sit back and say, yeah, there's Daddy.
Right.
He's back. You know what I mean? He had got over it. Himself and my mother remained friends, you know?
And we saw that she was in the court as well with you and Robert. But come back to what then transpired. You and Robert went searching, searching, searching. But you didn't know what had happened.
No, like, as I said, to different scenarios. Like, you always want to think of other options rather than your gut feeling. You know what
yeah.
I mean? Like, I remember the 3rd of June, you know, it was, that evening was kind of relatively gone, you know, that we had the defence forces and the search teams coming in, and they were kind of with us in the woods, kind of gathering information, you know, on Daddy, and you had the helicopter circulating up ahead of us. So that evening, we stayed in the woods all evening, and just before the shop closed in the local village, Bansha, I went up and I got a bottle of Lilt and a bar of fruit and nut in case Daddy did come out of the woods. You know, he'd have something. And I refused. I remember the guards were closing off the bollard, and I refused point blank to leave the woods that day.
Right.
And I stayed outside the woods all night. And 'twas early the following morning, I pulled myself back, we'd say, from the family and the search teams that were going into the entrance to the woods. And I went up around the back. It's a place called Christ the King, the statue up there. And I just got out of the car and I was walking down this narrow path through the woods. And I just said to myself, Michelle, you know this isn't your father. Like, Daddy, you're not going to see him again. And if you do see him again, he's not going to be able to talk to you. You know, that was what I was telling myself walking down here, that no way Daddy would have left us in despair. Because he knew we would have been in despair.
Yeah.
You know, and he wouldn't have done it. He would not have done it. He would not have left us. And I'm 100% to that. And I was always 100% to that. But it still didn't stop us. We had to do something. There was no such thing as coming home. We had to, Like, we were eating, sleeping, drinking, searching.
Yeah.
The search was our, it was our way of living. It was the only thing we knew how to do then.
Yeah, because it was very interesting how quickly you spotted when you did find the van in Bansha Woods that the seat was in the wrong place. There was a mystery there, I suppose. So you were like that for 22 months.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how did you find out that your father's body had been found?
Yeah, it was Superintendent O'Callaghan who actually rang me to say that there had been a body found in Fáinne-Gowan. You know, I honestly can't praise Superintendent O'Callaghan enough. He has been absolutely superb from the first day I ever got in contact with him right up through to Wednesday.
Yeah.
I have to say that man went up and over and beyond his call of duty regarding us as a family.
Well, that's good to hear.
He did, yeah.
And, but your boy was in the car with you, wasn't he?
What happened? I was speaking with Superintendent O'Callaghan, and I got such a shock that I never actually heard the back door of my car opening. My son had come out from school and got in. It was like I was sitting there, but I couldn't hear anything going on around me. I never heard from the car door opening, and I never heard from getting in. I was completely paralysed. I was frozen in the front seat, and I was there. I just kept thinking to myself, "How am I going to ring Robert? How am I going to tell Robert?" Like, what do I do now? What do I do? Like, I mean, I couldn't put it into words. I was there with the scenario. How am I going to break the news to Robert? You know?
Yeah.
It was one of them situations where
you knew his body had been found. Did you know any other details?
Nothing.
Right.
Nothing. No. Nothing.
Right.
At that point, on that day, we knew nothing else, only that there had been a body found in Fáinne-Gowan. We didn't know the location, weren't sure of anything, really, you know. But when I actually got down there that evening and I was standing at the side of the road, it was like, why? Why?
Yeah.
And to this day, we still carry that question.
Tell me then, because it must have been very difficult. How did you go about the funeral?
Oh, the funeral. I have to say that my father's brother, John, our uncle, was absolutely amazing. He really and truly was, because I don't actually think that I could think of anything straight.
Yeah.
You know, it was, and the funeral directors, Devitt's down in Cashel, I mean, they were absolutely outstanding. You know what I mean? They really and truly were. They made it so, for the situation that we were in.
Yeah.
You know, they absolutely went above and beyond to ensure that, you know, that Daddy had the best send-off, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they really did.
And of course you couldn't see the body, and it was a closed coffin. Did you get a hint of how bad things were at that time?
Look, I mean, I know we were told that it was a traumatic death that he suffered. So, I mean, you know, given light of that, I suppose we were kind of drawing our own conclusions.
Yeah.
I remember we were sitting inside in the funeral home, and just before they removed Daddy to the hearse to remove it to the chapel, I just hugged the coffin. I just hugged the coffin. It wasn't, you know, it was Daddy I wanted. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
For me and Robert, like, we wanted Daddy up out there. We wanted to just open up that lid and bring Daddy out. But, I mean, we couldn't do that.
Yeah.
But, you know, hugging the coffin, it was just like, no, I want Daddy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I want Daddy back at where he belongs with us. He doesn't belong in there, you know? So... emotional. It was just, you know, that sadness, and that has always stuck with myself and Robert to this day. You know, I always remember how we just latched onto that coffin. If I could have started around the funeral home, I would have had to stop him from bringing Daddy out to the back of the horse. Do you know what I mean? We had him back. We were left without him for 22 months. We had him back and now they wanted to take him away from us again. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I can only guess at it, of course. And tell me how long between that and the court case and the whole process and attending and listening and watching?
Oh, well, to get to the 14th January 2019, there was a lengthy, a bad process. I have to commend the Tipperary Town Gardaí for that, and Inspector O'Callaghan. Like the hours that they put in around the clock.
Yeah.
And the forensics and, you know, everybody, I really and truly can't commend them enough. To compile this case, to get us, you know, to get it past the DPP, you know, and yeah, into courtroom number 13. You know, it was a lengthy process. You know, there was days they were saying, you know, God, but is it going to happen? Are we ever going to get justice? And then when the court actually started, we were there saying, can we actually rewind the clock and go back another few months? We didn't want to be sitting there, because at that time then, you know, before it went into courtroom number 13 in the criminal court, we were there saying, no, justice would be done, you know, justice would be done. And then when we were actually sitting there, you know, it was 50-50. Are we going to get justice, or are we going to walk away from this? And nothing.
I saw a quote from you where you said, words to the effect of, this lies in the hands of 12 strangers.
Absolutely. You know, throughout the trial, like, I mean, it was a very long trial. I remember when Miss Justice Eileen Creedon sent the jury out for deliberations. I remember just walking out and I said, you know, it's in the hands of 12 strangers whether or not Daddy can rest in peace and we ever close an eye again.
And tell me, after all that time and all that trauma and all that sadness, what was the court experience like you were looking at Patrick Quirk? You were looking at kind of all the principal people in this. How did you cope with that? And how did you assess him?
Well, I think for myself and Robert, we tried not to look at him.
Right.
Where possible. You know, like, there was times there where you would kind of glance over or whatever, but we kind of made a point to ourselves that, you know, where we could avoid him, we would. You know?
Yeah.
You know, there is that sense to us that, like, still, even though he's sitting there, you know, you kind of still have to have a certain restraint in yourself and say, you know, innocent till proven guilty. You know, that was the motto we had to stand by, you know.
For things like, we've heard, you know, that his wife was with him, that they had a packed lunch occasionally or went up to the Phoenix Park. So were you bumping into him as you went in and out and he went in and out?
Yeah, I mean, like, he would have been around the same area that we were, you know, the cafeteria, or, you know, out in the corridors, you know, going down to the train station in the mornings and the evenings. You know, he would have been there, you know, but I suppose the only thing that we done was, you know, well, you have to think of Daddy in this, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we weren't going to do anything to jeopardise our chances of justice, you know.
Yeah.
If it was ever going to come to justice, we weren't going to do anything to jeopardise that. So, you know, I'd say it was our father in that court walking with us hand in hand, you know, to get us to hold our head up and our back straight.
Yeah.
You know?
And, I mean, I'm very conscious, but you've been through it, of the fact that this is your father. When you saw what was described as a concrete sarcophagus, and when you saw the pictures of that, which I gather you did by accident.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to put myself and the listeners into your shoes. You know, this is cataclysmic. cataclysmic in your life. You want justice for your father, and you have to go through this process.
Yeah, like when I saw, first of all, they did show, obviously the body, you know, wasn't in it when they showed where Daddy was. It kept for some 22 months. I was like, poor Daddy. You know, he was down in the cold. He was down in the dark, and he was down in the cold, you know?
Yeah. And for things like listening to other people giving evidence yourself, cross-examination, how was all that?
That was kind of like, you know, it was just kind of like, for myself and Robert, it was a process. As I said, we were sitting there every day hoping that we would get an answer to the question that we have, why.
Yeah.
That never came. Yeah. I don't think even if there was an answer, I don't ever think that it would ever be good enough. As a matter of fact, no, it would never be good enough, you know, no matter what anybody explanation would have to offer us.
I presume the whole concept of jealousy came into it.
You know, it was like Mr. Bowman did put across a very strong case, even though, as he did say himself, there would be no smoking gun in this. But I don't know. I mean, like, you know, there was the word jealousy. There was the word, you know, greed. I mean, that to us still isn't half good enough. You know, like there was nothing to be jealous over. Regarding my father, you know what I mean? Absolutely nothing. The man had what he had. He was delighted with what he had. You know, he was thankful every day that he was waking up. He was able to go and drive his trucks. He had his family.
Yeah.
You know, he had his music. There was absolutely, that's all that man wanted, was a happy life. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but there was a question raised that Patrick Quirk was obsessed by Mary Lowry, and that's where I'm talking about jealousy.
Okay. Yeah, you know, I mean, I know throughout the trial, you know, Daddy was lost severely in the goings on, you know, in the things coming to light about Mary Lowry and Pat Quirk. Obsessed, I don't know. Like, I mean, I'm going to be completely honest. I still don't know what to make of that whole situation, to be quite honest.
Right.
You know, it was very hard to listen to, because from where we were sitting, we were listening about Mary Lowry, we were listening about Patrick Quirk, but where was the mention of our father, you know?
Yeah.
So from that aspect, I think that was just, to us, another process and a step towards justice, you know, if justice could be got out of it, you know? I don't know, it was...
And what do you think... Or what, I mean, I hate asking people how they're feeling, because clearly you're heartbroken. But about Patrick Quirk now, do you hate him? Do you ignore him? How do you fix that up in your head?
Okay. Well, hate is a very strong word. I don't like using it.
Right.
I will never, ever, ever forgive that man for taking our world away from us, because that's what Daddy was. I'm not going to use the word hate.
Right.
I just don't like. But as you can imagine, it's definitely, you know, I wouldn't be, you know, saluting.
Yes.
The man.
And that's another thing. Will all the three families be constantly meeting one another? I don't mean meeting one another for in any kind of a sociable way, but like, I don't know, as you said at one stage, going for a train or going to mass or going into the supermarket. I mean, that's all in the future, isn't it?
Well, after Daddy had gone missing, Tipperary got too hard for myself and Robert. It really did. And we moved out of it. We decided to move up to Cork.
Right.
You know, things just got too hard. It was everywhere you go, I was getting into the frame of mind where every spare minute I had, I was driving back out to the bench of wood.
Yeah.
That wasn't good for me.
No.
You know, that wasn't good. Robert was, every spare minute he had, he was driving around looking for him. You know, like, we kind of felt at that stage like we have to just hand this over now into the hands of God and pray that God hands us back Daddy.
Will you ever go back to your home?
I will never. I will never move back down to Tipperary. No, and I think Robert is. I think Robert is the same. Even though we have wonderful, precious memories of Daddy down there, but at the end, it started off with memories that we will cherish of Daddy, but the memories were just, I don't know. It came to an abrupt end, and it was an end that we can't ever see ourselves going back because, you know, number one, this will never be over for us. You know, justice has been got to a degree, but we still feel, give me back Daddy, You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's never going to be over.
And you're going to have to explain it to your children. That will be some task.
Yeah, we do know that we are going to have to sit them down in years to come. We've gathered every newspaper from the time of the 3rd of June 2011, right up, with different appeals and, this, that and the other thing, right up until Wednesday, and we're still gathering them because there is still headlines, coming in through even yesterday.
Yes,
today, let them sit down, have a read of it if they want to, ask us questions as they're going along, or whether or not they don't want to see the papers, they just want us to sit down and tell it how it is.
Yeah. So it doesn't go away. And the punishment of losing your own home as well, on top of losing your father. And by the way, because I know she was there, how's your mother?
Yeah, she has been a tremendous support to myself and Robert. I know that they were separated,
yes,
or whatever. But at the end of the day, you can't walk away from 20 years. You know what I mean? There is still an attachment there to a degree.
Yeah.
She had two children from Dad, even though we're growing up now. But she was equally as upset as me and Robert sitting there.
Well, that was a support for you two as well. Now, I want to finish on an odd note with you.
Okay.
If I may. You're having a birthday party for two of your children.
I am, yes, yeah. My son, who's 10, and my daughter, who's one. That's going on tomorrow. They had it booked in. He wanted to have a birthday in the local gym. So I said, yeah, no problem. So booked it in anyway. I said that I'd take it for the bank holiday weekend in May. I said that, it would give us time after the course, because we weren't expecting it to run as long as it did.
Yeah.
So when it ended on Wednesday, I was there. No, we have to still press on with this because other than that, temper tantrums all over the place. We can't have that, So yeah. The excitement is great. For him, and
Well, I suppose that's what they say about life has to go on.
Life has to go on. It unfortunately it does. If I could stand still to the 1st of June, when I last saw Daddy, I would have wrapped him up in cotton wool and took him away with me. Do you know what I mean? If we had to have known now. Or knowing them of what we know now.
Yeah.
But, life does go on. The hours and the days tick on. But to us, we're still back there at the 3rd of June. There's not a day that goes by that we don't, get flashbacks. Even we say that you talked about me being up in the stand, giving evidence.
Yeah.
I actually remember going into a full-blown panic attack that day because I was grand. I was talking about Daddy, but the minute they asked me to bring it back to the woods and find in the van, the smell that day in the woods just gripped me again, and the heat on my face and where I was with the van. It's we're talking nearly 8 years down the line, and it still has a grip on us, that degree. It'll never be over for us.
Well, I suppose that is the truth.
Yeah.
Listen, thank you so much indeed for talking to us and giving people an insight into what you've been through, what Robert has been through, and what members of families go through in these kinds of situations, because they can get forgotten.
Oh, I always said it, you know, like listening, you could be listening to the radio there before we had our own, you know, father taken from us, but you'd hear it on the radio, you know, somebody putting out an appeal for a loved one that's gone missing. And, you know, I mean, it's not until it comes to your own front door do you ever imagine how that family are feeling, what they're going through, you know. And I mean, the support that we have got from the public, you know, from the searches from day one right up until Wednesday, really ensure, like, we cannot thank the members of the public on Garda Síochána, the search and rescue teams, everybody, the victim support unit in the courts.
The courts, yeah.
We can't thank anybody enough.
Okay, Michelle Ryan, thank you very, very much indeed, and the very best of wishes to you, your brother and your families.
Thank you very much, Marion.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.